Hello and welcome to Radio Inqilab, a podcast focused on change makers who are working to educate, resolve, and change the complex systems within which we live. Radio Inqilab aims to bring voices to the forefront who have traditional as well as modern solutions for our planet, can share knowledge on how we take decisive action and live in harmony with each other and Mother Earth. In this time of chaos, disinformation, and negativity, Radio Inqilab seeks to focus on ideas that work and the positive impact they can have. My name is Rupande Mehta, and I come to you from Lenape Land in New Jersey. Our guest today is Yasmin Nair. Yasmin Nair is a writer, activist, media, and cultural critic and academic. She's a co-founder with Ryan Conrad of the Radical Queer Editorial Collective Against Equality and the policy director of the Chicago Queer Radical Collective Gender Just. Her work has appeared in numerous publications like The Baffler, In These Times, Vox, and Electronic Intifada, as well as in several anthologies, including Captive Genders, Trans Embodiment, and the Prison Industrial Complex, False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton, Queer and Trans Migrations, Dynamics of Detention, Deportation, and Illegalization, and Surviving the Future, Abolitionist Queer Strategies. Nair's work emerges from an anti-racist, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, and abolitionist perspective. But she's also critical of the banal form of identity politics that suffuses most woke left writing. She can be found on Twitter at Nair Yasmin and on her website, yasminnair.com. This conversation took place in January of this year. This is part one of a two-part conversation with Yasmin. Yasmin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on here. It's a pleasure. Thank you, Rupande.
I'm really excited to have this conversation with you today. So let's start off by talking a little bit about how did you become a writer?
Oh, so I was on an academic track, and then I realized that being an underpaid lecturer adjunct wasn't actually letting me write, which is what I really wanted to do all my life. So I went into various kinds of freelance writing and journalism, and that's how I am where I am right now. It basically, writing is all I've actually ever wanted to do. And I'm writing. It's not particularly well paid, but it's what I wanted to do.
I was about to say freelance writing is not usually one of the most coveted jobs, but I guess it brings a satisfaction that you've always wanted.
You know, it allows me to tackle subjects that I've always been thinking about, and I can write about a range of issues. I can choose what I wish to write about. Well, for, you know, that's complicated, not to, I have weird, unique advantages because of being an underpaid freelancer. So we'll just say that.
Well, I hope that changes for you soon because I think that you are a very good writer and a very prolific writer at that too. So here's hoping that that part of your life changes soon. I want to talk to you about one of the pieces you wrote that I am sure you got a lot of flack for as well as positive praise. On August 23rd, 2024, you wrote an article titled "Kamala Harris Will Lose." Walk me through the signature reasons Kamala Harris lost.
So a major reason, the large, I think, overarching reason was that she was not a politician. She was only a candidate. And I think voters recognized that right away, voters across the spectrum. And what I mean by that is Kamala Harris has always only been a candidate. Even if you look at her career in California, for instance, she's always only been the person who wants the job. And that's it. She wanted power. She wanted to be in a particular position, and she often won those elections. But I think when she ran for instance, when she tried to be the presidential candidate in 2020, and she lost miserably. I mean, it was as if she barely came up and then had to disappear because there was no note, there was nothing there. And then, of course, Biden chose her as his VP and so on. But even then, I think the DNC recognized, everyone recognized that there was nothing there, there was nothing substantial. She has no convictions, she has no political agenda and so on. But I think then she got incorporated into the party as the vice presidential candidate, which was the biggest stroke of luck for her. But up till that point, until that point, she had never been anything but a candidate. And then, of course, again, luck was on her side when Biden was compelled to drop out. He did not drop out, as we know. He did not drop out voluntarily. And once again, she was in the position of becoming the most powerful person on the planet, but by sheer luck, because the DNC didn't have the courage to actually look for candidates or even open the candidacy and so on. So again, by sheer luck, she was in that particular position and garnered, what was it, about $1 billion, or now I think we're realizing about $2 billion in donations and so on. But again, she never had any, I think she never had any political agenda of her own. And even when asked, I think the biggest moment in that sense was when I think she was on the Colbert show, and he, of course, is a liberal and very generous to her, and generously asks her, how would you be different from Joe Biden? And her response was essentially, I love the American people. I can't tell you how much I love the American people. And then essentially, there is no difference. Right. So when you are a poli my attitude about politicians has always been, a politician is someone who has an agenda, and their work might not always agree with what you with your perception of what they should be doing. That's fine. That is the push and pull of politics. You elect someone, they are there to do certain things for the electorate, and you may not always agree with how they go about it or what they do, but that is the push and pull. And you have to have someone who actually has, frankly, an ideology. Americans tend to think that there should be no ideology. And the left right now is in this space where it wants no ideology. But you have to have a politician who's a politician because they have an ideology. And Kamala Harris had nothing. She was this little blip in the air, really. What she was a candidate. So her only justification for election was, I'm all you have against Trump. I'm not Trump, which is exactly what Hillary Clinton also said, which is exactly why Hillary Clinton also lost. I'm not Trump. I'm the only thing, I think what she said was, I'm the only thing standing between you and the apocalypse, is what Hillary Clinton said. And so that's exactly what Kamala Harris was saying. And I think that is the overarching reason why she lost. And I think, in terms of particulars, yes, her refusal to engage or even show any really, really any respect towards those who are protesting the genocide, the ongoing genocide right now, in Gaza, her wishy-washy liberalism. In a world that has actually shifted a great deal, even conservatives, even if they're not turning lefty, have to now acknowledge a more left perspective on issues, on economic issues. The labor movement is strong. Well, it's not, I wouldn't say it's strong, but it's certainly rising. But the point being that she was no longer, I think she still was part of a liberal conversation around matters where the country has fractured and in many ways is considering radical agendas and is also faced with a world where the United States is no longer seen as any kind of moral authority. And she was basically recycling, I think, a very 1990s vision of the US. So there are all those multiple reasons, and I'll stop there and let you interrupt me, please. But that's the overarching reason. I think that's what's really important to keep in mind about Kamala Harris. She lost because she was never a politician. She did not have the guts to declare herself a politician. She was only ever a candidate.
You made some obviously some very interesting points, and the one about ideology I want to get back to. But before that, I was in Atlanta about 2 weeks before the election, and you talked about how on the Stephen Colbert show she kind of started talking about American people and so on and so forth. And in Atlanta, they kept playing this clip from The View, where she was asked, "Will you be any different than Biden?" And she said, "I not a thing," or something like, "Not a thing comes to mind." And I was there for a week, and I cannot tell you the number of times. Every time I turned on my TV, within the space of an hour, I think that commercial played maybe a dozen or, two dozen times, constantly reminding people that she will do nothing, different from Biden. But I mean, that was like I felt a very tone deaf answer. Right, because there were a multitude of things that she could have done. Do you think that there was sort of a lack of recognition on her part, or do you think that she just simply didn't have the guts to stand up and say, "I'm not going to be different than, Biden"? Because we know that people are suffering, right? We know at an economic level that some of the things that they have, the administration did not go to the people. There is still a very high inflation, and there was a very interesting article on Vox that talked about why that happened. And in spite of some many senior advisors telling him not to pass a package that he did, he went ahead and did it. But there are some real reasons why people are suffering on the ground. What do you think happened with her? Do you, like she just didn't care, or she just didn't know? I mean, neither is excusable, but which one do you think it is?
I think it's 70-30 perhaps, or 80-20, but I think genuinely she doesn't care. There is nothing about Kamala Harris's career that tells me that she has any sense of what people need or that she cares. And I'm thinking about, for instance, the moment years ago when she laughed about putting parents of school children for truancy in jail. Right? She laughed about that. And I think that she has never had any desire to do anything but gain power. And I think, she also comes out of California and from within very wealthy urban areas where the people she represented, or rather the people who got her elected, were not people who had any kind of economic needs or any huge problems like the one that we see across the country. So I don't think she's ever had to think about those issues. She's never had to think about, well, what does it mean to be always precarious in terms of one's income, or to be precarious in terms of health insurance, to be precarious in terms of rent or housing. Anything like that. So I don't think she has ever had to think like that. And I think the fact that she presents such a desirable, literal desirable face in terms of her identity, right? She's of Indian origin and of African, origin. Wonderful. Yay, we hit the jackpot. So I don't think she's ever really, there's nothing in her career that tells me that she really has ever cared about voters on a national level. She's only had to care about people on a very particular local level. And I also don't think she has political imagination, because again, she's never had to have political imagination. So there's that as well. She genuinely, I think, did not understand the question, I suspect. And what struck me is that this is someone who had that much money and had access to this gigantic trove of intellectual labor in terms of people who could help her prepare for interviews and so on. That was the most basic question. And she was asked that at least twice, did we know? You're right about the View interview, which came before Colbert. And then the response at the Times then should have been for her team to rally around her and say, this is a question that's going to come up again. Let's prep you for this." Even if it was a facile, sort of ready-made little speech that they wrote for her. Yeah, memorize this. But with the fact that even after the View debacle, right, she did not think it important or necessary to prepare for that question ever again. And then she goes up on Colbert, which has an even bigger audience and is resolutely liberal lefty, progressive, let's say, almost, kind of, sort of. And she still didn't prepare. So what does that tell you? That this woman has asked the same question twice, at least, that we can remember, and she never bothered. Her contempt for people, I think, is what we have seen over and over again. Her utter and complete contempt. And I think that whole campaign, they had two, I can't get over the number, it's around $2 billion that they raised. And what did they spend it on? Things like projecting on that huge sphere in Las Vegas. I'm still unclear as to what that did. Who on earth, on the planet, was going to look at that, and so on. But no, I think she is tone deaf. She's never had to think of herself as a politician. She's always only been a candidate. So it's shocking to me, and I forgive me for repeating myself, but it is shocking to me that she was asked that question, she flubbed it badly, and then she never prepared for it again.
I mean, two things that really blew my mind. One is that she was not prepared for it in the first place, because that is a very easy question that you have to be ready for as a candidate running at that level. And second, you were asked it again and you weren't prepared for it. So it was kind of like that was sort of, she wrote her own obituary with that. There was one moment, I really didn't keep tabs on her appearances and stuff because I very much agreed with your opinion that she was going to lose. And so I had kind of written off the whole thing. But time and again, things popped up here and there. There was one moment, I think she was with Oprah. I don't remember. And, the elite Hollywood gang was there. And I think it was Meryl Streep. And Meryl Streep said to her, accidentally, yeah, exactly. Madam President or something. And then, they all laughed and she's like, oh, oops, I'm sorry. I mean, Madam Vice President. And Kamala Harris says, oh, in 28 days. And I was flabbergasted at that.
Arrogance, the
That the
arrogance.
sheer arrogance, and the only thing at that moment that came back to me is like, she's going to lose. She's going to lose miserably. She's going to do a Clinton 2.0. Because that was the arrogance that Clinton showed as well. Like, oh, this is already in the bag. Like, there is no way I'm losing this.
Absolutely.
And I'm thinking, y'all didn't learn anything from any of the mistakes, or maybe you don't want to learn, right? And then the other part about her is I did not know much about her life before the Senate. And when you start digging into her life as a prosecutor and an attorney general in California, you realize how seriously problematic this woman is. She claims to be liberal, but she's very tight with the cops. She's very close to sort of this whole idea, like you mentioned about the truancy of the mothers and how she was laughing about it. There is no empathy there. And I'm thinking, this woman has received everything very easily in life, and she's never had to work for it. So you're right in that sense that she never really had to think about how to address an audience that was outside of the liberal, safe California, sort of audience that she had to deal with in the rest of the country. So it was very obvious to some of us, right, that she was going to end up where she did. But the way she lost, I mean, it was, not shocking, but it was still kind of a little surprising, I feel, especially with all the money that she had raised and everything that she just completely mishandled. So anyway, let's talk about Trump for a second. You earlier mentioned that, a candidate needs to have some sort of ideology. What is your ideology? What is Trump's ideology, rather?
That's a good question, because this is a man who changes in some ways, often changes. I think his ideology is a presented one, which is to say, I think, first of all, I think his ideology is to stay in power, which is understandable. But I think I don't. Okay, let me go back and think. Let me just frame this in terms of a history of Trump, as it were. I think we want to think about ideology and politics in terms of the histories of people. So I think something that we tend to forget about Trump is that, first of all, he was a hero to many people in the 80s and 90s. David Renick, the editor of The New Yorker, is now trying to rewrite history by saying, oh, we always hated him in New York. We had such. That's not true. If you watch shows like, all the cop shows, like, why am I forgetting all the names of the cop shows given how much I watch them? But, if you watch all those NYPD shows, CSI, and all of that, Trump is constantly coming up in old episodes. They'll refer to him as the Donald, and they're all very admiring of him in those shows. So Trump throughout the 80s and 90s was a success story. The New York Times even followed him around for this long piece that they did. In fact, they've and written about this. If people want to find these articles, they can look it up. But I've written about how reporters at the time would follow him around with awe and talk about how amazing he was as a builder, and they would describe his looks. There's this very fawning article in the New York Times about his beautiful, and he was, conventionally speaking, but he was a very good-looking man in his youth, sort of tall Adonis, et cetera, blonde, and all of the rest of it. So, and I bring that up because when you ask what's his ideology, I think we tend to forget that Trump came out of a certain kind of liberal arena, out of New York City. We forget his daughter and his son-in-law are Jewish. His mentor, Roy Cohn, was a gay man. It was not openly acknowledged, certainly, but everyone in the circles knew that he was gay and so on. So he comes out of actually a very liberal arena, which we tend to forget because the liberals today want to disavow him. But so when we talk about ideology, I think we are often tempted to think in terms of liberalism versus the opposite. We can talk later about how bankrupt leftism is in this country right now. But in terms of liberalism versus conservatism, we tend to forget that, yes, there are economically conservative policies, sure. And he comes out of the model of gentrification, the model of, the oppression of his own tenants, for instance. He was a horrible landlord. His father was a horrible landlord, all of that. But he traveled in that liberal sphere, the mega donors of museums and so on and so forth. So when you ask what is his ideology, I think his ideology is whatever it takes to get elected. And I think at some point he realized that whipping up this kind of conservative, not just conservative, but extreme right-wing hysteria around, for instance, immigration, abortion, and all of that. Abortion, what's interesting is that you'll notice that he sometimes flip-flops on abortion, depending on whom he's talking to and when. But he whips up this kind of extreme right-wing hysteria because he knows that's what's going to get him elected. And so, in terms of ideology, I think Trump's ideology is getting elected. And that's, if you were to tell him tomorrow that, if change your mind on immigration because that's where the country is moving and even the MAGA people think da da da, he will change his policies and he will change his rhetoric. So he's, in some sense, the ideology that he draws from is one that exists in parts of the country, but you can't really pin him down. And I think this is where I think the left and liberals have failed with Trump is because they keep thinking, well, we can just pin him down. And if we can, for instance, shame him on X issue, he'll change. But that's not what's happening. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that, yes, Trump is Trump. I was just looking at, and he is, in some ways, a remarkable figure. You know, the Financial Times just declared him the person of 2024, and they're right. They're absolutely right about that. It is, but he has behind him a range of interests, economic interests, political interests. He has big donors, for instance, who are very set on Israel being a politically dominant, violent force, etc. He has, developers and so on. So he has this neoliberal and politically right-wing apparatus behind him, all of whom also have economic interests. And he's happy to be the front man for all of that. So when you, it's very difficult, I think, to talk about Trump and ideology without understanding how complex that is in terms of his political beliefs syncing with whoever is supporting him and whoever can keep him in power. So I think that is the difficulty, I think, with Trump. And that's a good question because I think it should prompt us to ask, well, does he have an ideology? And if not, what does that mean?
Yeah, it is an interesting thought. It's almost like, I was trying to understand in my mind as you were talking, how do we define or differentiate rather Trump and Harris, right? They're both motivated by power, which is to say nothing really, any politician is motivated by power. So that's like the bare minimum there. But I think maybe the difference that you could say between the two is one is willing to flip whichever way need be for power, while the other is sort of maybe a little bit static in that respect. Like you could pin her down on certain things. She's just clueless about things, but I think that maybe that's how I would differentiate the two. What do you think?
Yeah, I think she's such a terrible candidate and a terrible politician. Kamala Harris should just be relegated to the dustbin of history. Honestly, she just needs to disappear. And I think Kamala Harris has just been useless, has been a nothingness, a kind of a void. And we should just move on from her. I think she's not even worth. She is kind of like a second tier administrator who remarkably was pushed onto the international stage by sheer luck. There's no other way to think about this. It was just pure happenstance that she ended up where she ended up. She never had any kind of real agenda. She does not have a personality. I think she is so trivial that I think we just need to move on from Kamala Harris, And I don't mean in our conversation, I mean in terms of politics. I think we just need to just forget about her and understand, give her that we should maybe give her some. Well, I don't think we need to give her any post at all. She should just retire early.
I mean, there's nothing more left for her at this point. I think that she just, maybe opens a private practice and does what she's doing, wearing those 60,000 Tiffany necklaces and parading around. I mean, how tone deaf can one be? It was just very staggering. Anyway, I think we can talk about this all day, but we can maybe move on and come back to it later if need be. There's a lot I want to talk to you about. So let's move on to immigration here for a second. So you write that no one is interested in fixing it, not the left or the right or the immigration movement. I put that in quotations. But if the public wants to do anything about it, you say we need to change the ways we talk about and conceive of the figure of the immigrant. That means we stop describing immigrants as poor, sad people who bring their beautiful ancestral spirits everywhere they go, and instead see them as part of a larger historical reality that has to do with labor and globalization, as well as the simple desire of people to move in order to find different lives. We have to stop talking about them as people who enrich countries, as hardworking immigrants whose work makes our lives better. Everywhere among liberals and leftists, the first impulse is to always justify immigrants as, for instance, people who do the work most Americans won't do. This is not a progressive or a leftist vision, but in fact, the deeply racist idea of the immigrant ingrained in the notion that they are lesser people simply here to make our lives easier. It reduces them to servile dependents who need our condescension and kindness to be allowed to survive. I know that was long, but I really wanted to read that out because I thought that was just so beautiful. It's also a very simplified and humane way of looking at immigration that gives immigrants equal status as people. Talk to me about this.
Thank you for reading that out, actually. Thank you very much. The big shift that came about in the United States, if you just look at the US for a second, in terms of immigration and quote unquote immigration reform, was around, I would say, the late 90s. And what happened is that immigration went from being a labor issue to an issue of identity. And what we saw in the aughts, especially just around and before the first Obama election, was the rise of, you may remember them, the rise of the undocumented youth, the Dreamer movement. And I write about this extensively in my current book project, where I have one and a half, two chapters actually on this matter. What happened at that time was, you saw the rise of a population of people who had actually grown up. By then, they had grown up in the United States as undocumented youth and were demanding change and quote unquote reform. But they were very particular about presenting themselves not as in any way connected to labor and not in any way connected to their parents who might have been laborers and farm workers or undocumented, those nasty undocumented people working in the shadows, etc., but as young people who were all unfortunately unable to fulfill their dreams of going to Yale and Harvard and become doctors and lawyers. Because of the circumstance of their birth, they had been brought here illegally by their parents through no fault of their own. And I say all of that in that particular tone because this is exactly the narrative that they presented, which was the narrative that the immigration rights movement realized was a way to start to feature immigration again front and center. So you no longer had to think and talk about bracero programs or the exploitation of farm laborers. Or NAFTA. People were tired, apparently, quote unquote, of speaking about NAFTA, which, incidentally, as we all know, was a Clinton era issue, etc. But you now had identity as the locus of immigration reform, and not just any identity, but a beautiful, sad, talented, identity of the undocumented. And of course, within the undocumented, you also had undocu queers. And by the way, those movements actually began not just in California, but actually they're centered in Chicago. So I was actually there watching all of this. And that shift from immigration as a matter of labor, the global push of migrants, for instance, from Mexico to the US because of NAFTA, because local economies were being decimated. Those issues were all now pushed aside in favor of sad undocumented youth. And for over 10, 15 years, and now I think it's been now, what, 20 odd years or more, that has been the only narrative that the immigration movement, quote unquote, as you put it, has been able to focus on. So what has happened is that what you have now consequently is a large mass of people who still are migrating. And this has to do with labor, this has to do with wars in different countries. We're talking about Syrian refugees, or whether we're talking about Mexican refugees coming in because of economic circumstances and so on. All of that has produced a massive population of people whose identities don't align with, quote unquote, the undocumented, and who are now seen as disposable and unnecessary, and they are demonized, as we know. This is what Trump is doing. Trump is not demonizing the undocumented youth, you notice. He's demonizing the very people he thinks are just a replenishable, endless supply of migrants who will do the work that no one, quote unquote, no one else wants to do, and so on. So I think that split is something that no one wants to address, because the left and liberal media really glommed on to the undocumented population, right? That particular identity formation. And now what has happened is that the only recourse we have, the only response we can have to the merciless policies towards immigration that Trump is proposing, the only recourse we have to that, the response we have to that is, oh no, but so sad. No, it's all so sad. We're going to go to the airports and, challenge any mandates, etc. So it's all responsiveness, but there has been, in the meantime, nothing within the immigration rights community that says, here is our legislative agenda. Here is what we propose as a series of changes. Nothing. We've seen nothing from immigration rights organizations. What we've seen is constant responsiveness. Yes. A kind of knee-jerk response. And that can be great in some cases, but it's not a sustainable solution. So immigration in the US has failed miserably, not because there's this extremist right-wing agenda, but because the left never had a solution in contrast. What does the left have? I mean, give me one piece of legislation that the left has ever proposed, left liberals and the left.
That is such an important point, right? It's not because we tend to look at this, it's all kind of at face value, right? Something happens, everybody kind of goes and marches for 10 days, and then we're all back in our homes and everything is fine. And then something happens again. So much so that, I don't even think that this time around in his second term, there's going to be a lot of noise. I feel like people are just going to kind of try to get into business as usual sort of way, and not be bothered, because that's how it has usually been. Like, make some noise and then go home, right? You said that these folks are coming in from other countries, from all these other countries and stuff. The interesting thing there is that they're all coming in because of some or the other kind of US intervention in their countries, right?
Exactly.
So for the immigration rights movement to kind of just focus on this and not focus on that, I think partly, do you think it's because that would lead to sort of just, more understanding and education around what an imperialistic power this country, the United States, is, and how it has gone out there and really decimated people for their own political and, strategic interests? You're mute.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I'll give you my first and most cynical response. And I don't mean cynical in a bad way. I mean that we do, because I think we actually have to practice cynicism on the left. We need more of it. My most cynical response, first of all, is that the immigration rights community, which is dominated by these extremely wealthy organizations like ICIRR in Chicago, which is the, it's a long, I can never remember the exact, what the acronym stands for exactly. Illinois Coalition for Refugee Immigrant Rights. It's the largest of such organization in the country, I believe. But the point I'm trying to make here is the cynical point, which is that it's about funding. It's about donors. It's about who will fund them if they go on the path of thinking and arguing about immigration on the lines of economic and political solutions. If ICIRR, for instance, or any other immigration organizations were to shift the conversation to immigration as a political and economic, as a sim the immigration problem as a symptom of economic and political changes in the world that the United States brought about, they would see a sharp drop in their funds. And I know this from a personal level that that particular message, and I know this because I know this as an organizer around immigration for many years. I know this because I have organized, for instance, panels and activist events to which mainstream journalists would come and completely erase anything that was said about that particular analysis. And they focused on the sad undocumented people on the panel instead, or they focused on UAFA, the Uniting American Families Act, which was a way for gay couples. This was before gay marriage became legal. It was a way for gay, and of course, by gay, we mean here straight white, I mean, gay male, white people mostly being able to sponsor their partners to enter the country via marriage or via their relationships. Those were the things that people, the mainstream press, decided to focus on. And that's the kind of messaging that gets donors, right? It's sad, sad people, dying people, etc. If you go to the offices of ICIRR, the walls, at least at the time that I was there some years ago, the walls are replete with these images of crying children. Crying children. That's the message. Look at this, you know, look at these sad immigrants. The economic, yes, absolutely. There was always a way to talk about that, and that was the way we spoke about immigration at least 30 odd years ago. And that was not a fundable mission, as it were. And so we have a bankrupt immigration rights community, which now produces solutions in only in terms of responses to brutality, but also refuses actually to work with people who don't fit that narrative of sad immigrants. So, to give you one very concrete example, as an immigration organizer years ago, people would come to me and ask for resources for their cases, and that's, you know, and I would send them to these particular organizations that I thought were progressive, leftist, and then these people would come back to me and say they wouldn't take my case because I can't be defined via a family. You know, so these were, for instance, single gay men, for instance, but they didn't have the narrative that these organizations wanted. They didn't have a family, gay or straight. They couldn't talk about being wrenched away from their lovers and their husbands and their all of that, or their children, etc. And consistently, what I saw was even the so-called supposedly progressive immigration rights organizations refusing, actually, literally refusing to take up their cases. I mean, they were told bluntly in many cases, well, you know, you're just not a case we could win, so we're just not going to bother with you. They were told that in so many words. We won't win your case. So that has been the issue. It was never impossible for us to continue with that message. But people decided that Americans in particular didn't want to hear any of that. That's not actually true. You know, I actually have a strong belief in people's intelligence. The problem is the press, the media, you know, political institutions that have consistently insisted that people are not ready for any kind of complexity in their discussions about immigration. That is simply not true.
I think the media decides a lot more than just immigration. I feel like according to them, we're not ready for complexity around several of these issues, like housing, or let's talk about education, or anything. We can just run down the list, right? And everything is sort of controlled. The narrative is so controlled and defined. I was scrolling through Instagram today, and apparently this app called Red Note is taking hold now after TikTok's, possible ban. People in there were talking about how Chinese folks are, surprised and shocked that, we don't have insurance here, or it's tied to an employer, or, we have to pay all this for healthcare, and, just stuff like that. So the level of isolation that, and the media control that we have seen here is also staggering. You cannot argue any other way, and to the detriment of the people, right?
Yes, exactly. I lived for many years, I forget how many years now, but for over a decade in Indiana. And I lived in West Lafayette, Indiana, where the biggest employer, so there were these two cities, quote unquote, twin cities of Lafayette and West Lafayette. And West Lafayette was where Purdue was, which is the university that I went to. And the biggest employer there was the Subaru factory. And if Subaru, I have no idea what's going on right now, but if Subaru ever picked up and left, it would have devastated the local economy. And there was always this supposedly intellectual and ideological divide because West Lafayette was where the university was. So it was quote unquote more liberalish. And, he's like, and what I saw. The first thing I experienced moving to a place like that was the contempt that so many liberals and supposedly Marxist people had for the quote unquote locals. And in my students, I saw this the sense the students who were fr so in my among my students, there were two kinds of local students. There were those who had grown up in West Lafayette with perhaps professor parents or had gone to the sort of slightly more elite, well-funded public high schools, which were very well taken care of, et cetera. And there were students who came from the east side and whose economic circumstances were very different, whose high schools were funded differently, had different resources and so on. And there was always that tension. Right. And that tension between the two groups was translated as an ideological tension. Oh, look at these rednecks. And that was the first time I ever heard the term rednecks. And I really didn't understand. So, what do you mean rednecks? Why do you, and I had to be told what the history and the meaning of that term was. So, there was this whole distinction between the quote unquote rednecks and us. And I think that the fact that in a conservative state like Indiana, you can still have these bubbles where that division between quote unquote rednecks and us can be expressed so firmly and so clearly and so openly tells us a lot about how Americans live within these very fractured and fracturing narratives about class distinctions and about ideological distinctions. And I think media, which is increasingly focused, and I know this is a cliche, but unfortunately it's true, right? The media, quote unquote, the media is increasingly aligned along coastal distinctions. You have West Coast, and of course, you have the East Coast media. No one thinks about the Midwest, etc. But they really fundamentally don't understand what is happening in the rest of the country. And when they don't understand what's happening in the rest of the country and what people are actually going through on emotional and economic and political levels, their impulse is to simply reduce everything to these very stereotypical narratives of misogynistic, hateful, conservative people, anti-immigrant people, and the good liberals. And oh, there are no liberals. So the media, and the problem is the media is becoming worse and worse in the sense that, as we can see right now with things like the Washington Post or the New York Times, either, losing reporters, losing journalists, and becoming more like more like blogs than actual newspapers, for instance. I mean, there are all these media changes coming about, but that, and also now you can no longer be a person in media if you don't come from money. Because everything starting from unpaid internships is about, do you have access to capital, cultural capital, and also economic capital to even get into it in the first place, right? So, and what we're seeing is that kind of elitism in a sense that is reflected in the way they write about what's happening in quote unquote America and middle America, which is why so many people were shocked by the results of the election. Which is why, I didn't even bother pitching my piece to anyone, but I knew right away. I said, no one's going to publish this. I'm just going to put it on my own website when I said that Kamala Harris will lose. But the shock is reflective of the fact that they were never paying attention. And I'm rambling right now, so I'll stop. But yes, we are in a dire situation where the people who should be covering politics either don't have the resources or the willingness to actually think about what is actually going on in the country. And what people are affected by. I'll give you two examples about what worked and what didn't work. I followed The Guardian pod. They do the pod. They have this podcast about what's going on in the UK. I followed The Guardian podcast, and I was following The Daily podcast on the New York Times site. And in both cases, the worst discussions were in the round tables of these journalists who's in the UK, for instance, with The Guardian, were clearly more interested in attending the conferences and following the candidates around and eating food. They were always talking about food on The Guardian. And this is weird. They're like, oh, it was great. They gave us great food. And in the New York Times, it was these people again. Sitting around a table on the and chatting and talking about what was happening. But the best analyses were coming from their reporters who were actually on the ground. So on The Guardian, I forget his full name, I think his first name is John. Anyway, he was the only one going out and actually talking to people. And what I understood from that was that even if people voted for Keir Starmer, they were not happy about it. And it was only because of this roving journalist that I could understand that. And I predicted in my mind, I remember thinking, this is not going to bode well for Keir Starmer because no one is voting for, they're calling it a decisive victory. It isn't really. It's only decisive because the Brits decided that they didn't want the Conservatives around. But that is not the same as saying we love Labour, right? And now we can see how Keir Starmer, who is again worse, almost worse than Kamala Harris. He's like an evil Dilbert. Keir Starmer is not doing well. He's constantly running into roadblocks and of his own making. And that's a whole other conversation. Now, on the New York Times, the Daily podcast, I noticed there was this one journalist, and again, I apologize for the fact that, I haven't retained the names. There are so many of them. He was also, perhaps this is not coincidental. He was also the only black journalist that they had. And he was the one literally piling up airline miles as he flew around the country and spoke to people. And it was only through him that I was able to understand what the shift was in terms of race and but also economics and what people were really thinking. And he was the only one. So listening to him, I thought, this is not going to go well for her. So when you don't have, when you have like these huge news organizations like The Guardian and The New York Times, and most of their analysis and understanding of an election comes through people who are either just going to conferences for food or who are just sitting around a table in New York City, right? and you don't have a large pack of journalists around the country actually talking to many people, then you lose sight of what's actually happening. And that is the cost we're going to bear over and over again. So right now the New York Times is expanding its opinion pages. Like, why? Do we really need more opinions? No, we need more reporters. We need more journalists. We need more on the ground analysis. So,
Yeah, we need wealthy people writing opinion pieces like, Maureen Dowd and Paul Krugman and Jennifer Rubin
limit.
and
There really needs to be a time limit. I think that from here on, anyone who becomes an op-ed writer needs to be just given a contract that's maybe a year long, 6 months to a year. I think it needs to be contractual. And then you push them out and you get someone else. If you must have op-eds, at least do that.
yeah. Exactly. I just want to make one point about something you said, and then I want to actually ask you about something else. But you said about those roving journalists, right? And if you were not in that room, you didn't have access to the treasure trove of information. But just listening to this guy, you're able to conclude that
Exactly.
she's going to lose.
Right.
You can imagine one of two things, right? One, either they knew, which a lot of information has come out later and saying that the internal polls never showed that she was going to win.
Yes.
Or two, they didn't know. Again, both of them, neither are excusable, right? Because if you're in that position, you have access to all this information, and you're misusing it, then that's you don't deserve to be in that position.
And that
And
comes
that
back
comes back
to
to,
donors, and
right.
in the case of the New York Times, for instance, and The Guardian, it comes to reader subscriptions. If they had actually said, she's going to lose, our internal polls show that, our journalists indicate that, readers would have been furious because, again, unfortunately, a lot of, and I don't think it's the majority of readers, I think it's vocal readers. Right. And that's also the other problem is that news right now is configured as a gigantic social media spectacle rather than engaged readership and so on. So you'd have had a lot of angry people on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, and Blue Sky or whatever, whichever platform they were on, making a fuss about this and saying, I now refuse. I refuse to subscribe to the New York Times. I have ended my subscription. And there are times when that can be interesting, as with, for instance, with the Washington Post, when Bezos, yanked, and the owner decided, also with the LA Times, right, when the owners decided to not endorse, etc., and they lost what, 200. Anyway, but the point is. That even that kind of a move is not really a sign for hope. The Bezos thing, for instance, the Washington Post losing all the subscribers is not a sign for hope because why should we even care about a newspaper endorsing a candidate? Is that really the primary point? Candidates. So, and I actually have written a piece about this because what I pointed out was that the whole idea of endorsing candidates is actually very new. It's maybe from the mid-70s, 80s. Newspapers never did that. So now we're all acting like a newspaper endorsement or a refuse, is some kind of a refusal to have a newspaper endorsement is some blow against democracy. That's rubbish. It never was, and it shouldn't be. I get the anger. I get the idea of, okay, is this Jeff? But again, you have a multi-billionaire owning a newspaper. That's the real bad news.
What did you think was going to happen?
Right.
Right?
What did you think was going to happen in the first place? We have a system where the only way to support a media outlet is to have a billionaire own it. That is the problem. The problem
That in
isn't
itself.
billionaire thinks. The problem is that the billionaire owns this shit. And the same is true. I've written before and been ignored on the fact that Medium or Substack, these are all owned by people who could actually pay the writers who write on their platforms and generate revenue for them. But they don't pay these writers. Instead, they'll give crumbs to a few. They'll say, we'll make this deal with you for, I forget, I think Substack used to have those deals, right? Where you would be one of the chosen few and get some amount of money, which has now ended. That whole system has ended. And people are now protesting because Barry Weiss and Substack have this new deal. As if Barry Weiss hasn't been there since 2022. They were all talking about leaving Substack. And I said, what do you mean leaving Substack? She's been there for a long time. You somehow didn't notice that she was there and was wildly successful? The hypocrisy of all of this. What I find so troubling about American politics, and perhaps in terms of American culture as well, is how much of it is based around this constant affective register. It's all about feelings and emotions constantly being drummed up. And all of that is actually only happening because the platforms we're on require us to constantly be angry or hurt or upset or whatever. And there's no sense of what the systemic changes need to be.
Within the emotion.